Docs Clubhouse with Eric Lineberg, the Doctor of Baseball, only on blogtalkradio.com. The Doctor is in.
Thank you for being here in Docs Clubhouse. This is Eric Lineberg, the Doctor of Baseball. And as promised, we have part two with Seth Swirsky. Last week, you heard us talking about baseball and his books and music and baseball and life. And we're going to continue that again today. Towards the end of the show last week, we were talking about the letter from Paul McCartney that you received and were able to put it in the book, Something to Write Home About. But I wanted to ask you, because I know you've met McCartney. Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
Well, I was at my gym working out.
Here in Los Angeles?
Yeah, here in L.A. And I was doing sit-ups, and I was coming up for another sit-up, and I look at about 20 feet in front of me. There's somebody who looked a lot like Paul McCartney. And I knew it was immediately. And something just in me, I didn't think too much about it. I mean, it just happened.
Right.
I walked all the way around. I noticed that by fate, the running machine, he was on a running machine. And there was one right next to him that was empty.
Right.
So I got on it. And I looked over, I gazed over at his, and he's going at 7 miles an hour, which is a lot. And, I mean, he was really moving on that thing. And he's close to, I don't know, he was 70 at the time or something incredible. I'm trying to keep up with him. I'm much younger than he is. And I'm thinking to myself, I made this movie, Beatles Stories. I interviewed everybody in the Beatles' lives. And what am I going to say if he gives me a second? Like, what name can I throw out?
Right.
I'm thinking, well, I interviewed George Martin, but no, he's heard a million questions about George Martin. I interviewed Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys. He's heard too much about that. And I'm trying to think of somebody, and I just go blank because his machine, he starts to ramp down. And of course, I started to ramp down, and he noticed that I did. And I looked over at him, and he looked right in my eyes, and I am literally, I'm not 2 feet away from him. And he looks at me, he goes, okay, you can ask me a question. And I said, thank you, Sir Paul. I just want to tell you, I just made a movie called Beatles Stories. And I interviewed Norman Smith, who was your first engineer for almost all your songs past Rubber Soul. I mean, from the very beginning in 1962. Right. And before I got out the name Smith of Norman Smith, he said, Norman Smith. We loved Norman. He was like an uncle to us. We loved him. He starts to get into it. You met Norman Smith. You interviewed Norman Smith. Hurricane, Norman Smith. He goes, what's your name? So I said, Seth Swirsky. He goes, thank you so much. He took both my hands to shake them. He goes, thank you for the gift you gave me today. And I said, Paul, thank you for the gift you gave me for my life. I became a songwriter and a recording artist and things like that. And, you know, I'm not too fazed when I meet famous people.
Right.
Because, I've written for a lot of recording artists over the years. I've met my share. They're just people that do something different and cool.
They're just like you and I and all of our listeners.
Absolutely. You know, I admire them and respect and stuff like that. But Paul McCartney, to me, was so big.
Right.
So big, you know. And there you are. You're really right in front of these talking to you. And then a crowd started to come around and listen to the story he was telling about Norman Smith. And I picked the right guy.
Right.
And I realized later, because that interview that I did with Norman Smith was really spectacular. I mean, I went to Sussex, England. Mm-hmm. And he picked me up in the car. He's 84 years old. And he says, no one's interviewed me all these years.
Oh, my goodness.
No one did an interview. And I got the camera rolling. And so in my documentary, Beatles Stories, I kept the camera on, so we're in the car. I said, I can't believe I'm in the car with Norman Smith. And it was just so wonderful. He let me film him for 3 hours.
And how did you come up with that question, just on spur of the moment? How did you pick that question to ask Paul McCartney?
I just, you know, I had a connection to him because of the people I was interviewing.
Right.
I didn't want to do, what was I going to say? You've influenced my songwriting? He doesn't care about my songwriting. Although I did get to meet George Harrison twice. And the first time I met George, one of my songs, a song called Tell It to My Heart by Taylor Dane.
Right. I know everyone's familiar with that.
It was on the charts when he had come back with his song, Got My Mind Set on You.
Right.
He hadn't been on the charts in a long time. And somebody introduced me to him from my publishing company at the time, Warner Chappell. Mm-hmm. And they said, Seth Swirsky, George Harrison. And I said, George, I was listening to your song, I Need You, today. And he goes, oh, well, that was from The Help. I said, no, I think it was Help, not The Help. But yeah, right? It was hilarious. He goes, let me introduce you to the table of guys here. That's Tom, that's Roy, that's Bob. That's right. And he introduced me to the group that became the Traveling Wilburys.
Oh, man. You seem to be a guy who is in the right place at the right time often. You know, a lot of it I know is by design. You go certain places to accomplish certain things. But how about that happening?
Well, to bring it all back to baseball, Red Shaindeans once said, luck is the residue of design. And, you know, when you got a passion about something and you're going for it and you're right. in it, you got to be in it. You got to right. be in the things you like. Go all out. And then things seem to happen. You just meet the people you want to meet. You have the conversations. It's the same with relationships with people, too. If you're not out there dating a million people, you're not going to find that person.
That's right.
You got to
just right.
go for it. Go for it. I mean, life is taking chances.
Yes. Yeah. And baseball is taking chances. It's
very much.
So much connection, but as we said earlier, baseball is life. I sometimes say baseball transcends life.
Yes.
And as does music.
Yes.
It's time for a station break. We're going to be right back with Seth Swirsky, and we'll have some different kinds of questions for him. And you listeners are enjoying a very different kind of show because we're covering all these topics, not just baseball, but in a way, all related. Baseball, music, life. We will be right back.
Doc's Clubhouse, blogtalkradio.com.
Phoenix listeners and listeners visiting Phoenix, for the best sports bar experience in town, it's Brennan's Pub, 34th Street and Bell Road in Phoenix. The best sports bar, dining experience, and atmosphere you will find in the Valley. For great food, great scenery, all of your favorite sports teams on the big screen TVs. Happy hour Monday through Friday from 3 to 7 p.m. And Saturday, Sunday happy hour from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. Good food, good people, good times. That's Brennan's Pub.
Hi, this is Seth Swirsky, and you are in the clubhouse with the Doctor of Baseball, and so am I. Only on blogtalkradio.com.
Doc's Clubhouse with Eric Lineberg, the Doctor of Baseball.
We are back with Seth Swirsky. And Seth, again, I want to thank you for staying with me so long here. Let's talk about another part of life that is so integral to a lot of people's lives and also baseball related, movies. Mm. What's your favorite baseball movie?
I really liked The Rookie.
Mm-hmm.
I liked The Natural. I did not like Field of Dreams.
You didn't like Field of Dreams?
No.
Why is that?
I felt it was phony. I felt it was Hollywood, and it was too long, and it was too preachy, and it was too, you're supposed to feel all warm and fuzzy. And
right.
I felt that that's what they were trying to do. And
it was fantasy. It wasn't a real
story. I could get with the fantasy. I could get with the Wheatfields, but it's through the blender of Hollywood, and I don't really like too much through the blender of Hollywood, to be honest with you. I feel it's, you know, when they, it was just, it didn't feel real.
Right.
It didn't feel real to me.
And that's interesting what you just said about you don't like a lot about Hollywood.
Yeah.
And you live so close to the Hollywood sign. I find that fascinating.
Yeah.
But I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Older baseball movies like
I love
Pride of the Yankees.
Bad News Bears, I love.
Bad News Bears. The Babe Ruth story and Pride of the Yankees, of course, were picked apart by a lot of people who said that this didn't really happen, this didn't really happen. Do you think that movies, especially from that era, but even today, should be succinctly to the facts and no fictionalization and no veering off at all? How do you feel about that?
I think that, you know, baseball is fact-driven.
Right.
You know, so you really have to please the diehards.
Right.
But there's a fine line between, you can please the diehards, but you also have to bring in people that might like the game, but not know a whole ton about
right,
that.
Right.
So, and I think that's very doable. I think that's very doable. So I don't think it has to be, you know, just for the, you know, inside baseball people.
Right.
You know, there's enough of, there's so many great stories in baseball. They're good on their own.
Right.
You know?
Do you have a favorite of all those movies, baseball movies?
Oh, boy, there are so many. I would say, well, you know, I'm a sucker for Lou Gehrig, you know. I really just liked him so much as a person.
Right.
So it's hard for me ever not to watch Pride of the Yankees.
I'm the same way. Anytime I see it listed, I'm going to watch it.
Yeah, he's a guy that just loved his mom and dad and wanted to please.
Right.
You know, just was a, just a good guy.
Yeah, and went to Columbia University.
Went to Columbia and just, you know, when any guy has the fate that was the cards that were dealt to him,
right,
and then he shocks the world by that little speech he gave, you know, that he was the luckiest guy,
right,
because he got to live the life that he was living, that is just kind of above and beyond baseball.
Right.
You know, that's something that goes to everybody's lives.
Right.
It's about appreciating what you have, not what you don't.
Right.
In the biggest way.
Right. Yeah, and so many of us, I'm guilty of it sometimes,
yeah,
not remembering to be grateful for everything I have.
Very true.
And boy, you hit it right on the head about that speech.
Yeah.
And it's, to this day, it's so moving to a lot of people, and they remember the words.
Yes.
Lou Gehrig is one of those great players who even played towards the end when he was getting ill, put up some tremendous numbers during his whole career.
You know, 493 home runs, and he still had 3, 4, 5 years left in him,
right,
if he wanted to. So he's an over 600 home run guy.
Right.
And so he would have been talked about even more than he was. But it's a, he's above and beyond baseball. I think, right, he's a guy that you talk to about life itself.
Right.
You know?
Right. And there are other examples of players over the years, but I don't think I can name anyone who was at that level.
Yes.
When it comes to talking about baseball and life.
Yeah.
Let me get back to baseball and music, which we were talking about earlier. And specifically, some of the songs you've written. Have you ever heard one of those played at a stadium when you were there?
Oh, yeah. That's the fun of when you're writing songs, you know, that that become, you know, they're out on the radio or they're on, you know, they become hits,
right,
you know, for lack of a better word. The joy is when you're walking down the street and you're, you know, you're, there's a pizza place and out of the, you know, out of the restaurant, whatever, you're hearing one of your songs, or you're looking inside and you're seeing people, actually their mouths moving.
Right.
They're singing it.
Right.
You know, so many, many times when they've gone to break you know, during a baseball game or something like,
right,
that, even on TV, I'll hear things like Tell It to My Heart or Al Green's song Love is a Beautiful Thing. I'll just,
right,
hear that, and it's just a, it's just such a joy, you know. It's,
yes,
a great feeling.
Yes. Let me go back to the Beatles for a minute. Mm. The documentary, mm, you did on the Beatles, and again, this is not really baseball related, but we're talking about life, mm, tonight with you. How did you get the idea to do that documentary?
Well, it was the same thing really behind Baseball Letters. I just started writing letters to baseball players, and before I knew it, I was getting 10, 12, 15 of them back every day.
Right.
And I thought, you know, what's another passion of mine that I really love, you know? And it was obviously the Beatles growing up. I loved their songs. I loved their music. I loved everything about them. I wanted to be a Beatle when I was 7 years old. And I didn't know in what manifestation, just anything.
Right.
And I became a songwriter. But, you know, I thought I knew everything there was to know about them. I ended up, my first album came out as a recording artist.
Right.
And I found myself playing in the Cavern Club in Liverpool. And I'm thinking, wow, this is the street. These are the bricks. These are, this is, you know, right? This is the,
right,
center zone of the Beatles. And I brought a handheld camera and I started to film people and their stories about them. This was their hometown. It ain't that,
right,
big.
Right.
You know, and I heard stories I hadn't heard before and I thought, you know, I'm going to do what I did with Baseball Letters. I did that with letters. I'm going to do that through interviews.
Right.
And cut them all into 2-minute pieces. So before I knew it, I'm in Graham Nash's house. I'm in Art Garfunkel's roof overlooking the, you know, Central Park. He's telling me a great story about Lennon and Bowie. And I mean, there was so much, you know, I filmed Sir Ben Kingsley and John Voight. And,
right.
You know, how many people can you say directed John Voight and Ben Kingsley? I'm sure that's right. A trivia question. Seth Swirsky.
I will remember that. I'm going to use that. You know, I'm referred to as the Doctor of Baseball. He used to be on a show where people would call him with a trivia question and try to stump me.
Yeah.
And somebody tagged me with that name years ago and it stuck. But I'm going to remember that trivia question.
Yeah, okay.
Now, you won a lot of awards, that documentary. I've seen it. It's yes. Outstanding.
Thank you.
People like Art Garfunkel, how did you get a hold of them at the time? Had you already written Tell It to My Heart and your other songs?
Yes, but how I usually got to people, whether it was in my books or in Beatles stories, you know, the documentary, I would do things like I really wanted to interview Art Garfunkel. I knew he had a terrific story that hadn't been mined.
Right.
And if I went through his PR people or his record company, it would never get to him. And they would want to know what does he get out of it and where's it going to be. And there'd be just too much stuff.
Right.
So I always like to approach people through just a nice person that we both worked with.
Right.
And I looked up on all his records, who played guitar, who played drums. Oh, I know that guitar player.
Right.
And so I found out his email or his Facebook thing and I, you know, texted him or whatever it was at the time, in the mid 2000s. And I just told him the project that I was doing, that I would love to, if he was in touch with Art, to see if he could do it.
Right.
And then what I always did was to make it easy on him, I would write the letter as well on the bottom of the email. So all he had to do was forward it and not have to remember all the facts about the project.
Oh, that was a smart move.
Very, very easy to do. So before you know it, about 2 days later, when there were phone answering machines, I mean, they're not now, but
back in the old days.
Back in the super old days of 2005 or whatever, I got a message on my machine and it said, "Hey Seth, this is Art Garfunkel. If you're, I like your project idea and I'll definitely tell you my story. When you're in New York again the next time, give me a call, you'll come up to my place." And so I call him right back and I said, "Well, Mr. Garfunkel, thank you. Oh, call me Art. Come on. I love this idea. I want to do it. When are you going to be in New York next? A month, 2 months, whatever." I said, "What a coincidence. I'm going to be in New York tomorrow." He goes, "Fantastic. So you'll come up in 2 days. In 2 days. You'll travel tomorrow. You'll come up in 2 days. I said, "Let's do it." So we scheduled it. I wasn't really going to be in New York tomorrow. But when somebody says, like him, that he will do your project, do you know how many things can trip up your project?
Oh, yeah.
You better jump on that day. Now, you know it sounds easier said than done, that it costs a lot for a plane ticket, but you can find your way to make
it. I've had to do those kind of things myself a couple times, so I know exactly what you mean.
You have to get it and make it happen, and it's not about, when I'm in New York, I'll just look him up. He's going to forget about it. He's offered everything every day. What was that again? I don't want to re-explain it. It was hot at the moment. And before you know it, now the funny thing was after the interview, we go back, he says, "Come on down to my den," and he takes out a beer and, we're drinking a little bit. We're into the second beer at this point.
Right.
And he said, "What do you think of, do you think Paul Simon was I as good as Paul? What do you think?"
He actually asked
me. Yeah. So I was shocked. I said, "Oh, you were the Monet of voices." I remember actually saying
that. What a great line.
And we were talking and I said, "Did you get to know the Mamas and the Papas while you were, all you guys were making those hits, and did you crisscross the country and get to know Mama Cass and Denny Doherty and the Beatles and this and that?" And he's like, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, I really did. I got to know a lot of those people." You gotta understand, this is Art Garfunkel of Simon and Garfunkel.
Right.
Mrs. Robinson, much more than that.
Right.
We're not talking about a minor act.
Right.
And we're drinking together. You know what I mean? And that was the fun, and I'm sure you can relate to it. It wasn't just the interviews and it wasn't just the projects. It was everything that surrounded it. I didn't need to be best friends with these guys.
Right.
I didn't need to say, "Hey, Graham Nash, and we spent all afternoon together. I wonder if he'll invite me to a, backstage at a concert that I do or whatever." I didn't need to be friends with any of them. Baseball players, rock and roll stars, or anything like that.
Right.
I thought it was a gift every time I got to spend time with somebody that I'd grown up with, that I had a question for, that just to have a good fun with.
Right.
That's all it had to be.
And it's the kind of thing a lot of people dream about, being able to do something like that. And you're able to make it happen. We're going to take another station break. When we come back, I want to ask you about something that happened at Dodger Stadium a few years ago. So, listeners, we will be right back after this break with Seth Swirsky.
Doc's Clubhouse, blogtalkradio.com.
We have a job to do out here today.
To be a winning team, you have to work like a winning team.
My team depends on me.
And my team is 50,000 strong.
This is the Action Team. High school students and Major League Baseball players working together to train and inspire the next generation of volunteers.
I'm LaTroy Hawkins.
I'm Craig Kimbrell. And we're on the team.
The Action Team.
Our team is the Action Team. Get in on the action at actionteam.org. Are you in?
Hi, this is John DiAquisto. You're listening to Doc's Clubhouse on BTR Radio.
Doc's Clubhouse with Eric Lindeberg, the Doctor of Baseball.
And we are back with Seth Swirsky. And Seth, as we've been talking about, again, baseball and music and how they're tied together. Have you ever been invited to sing the national anthem or anything like that?
Well, yes. Actually, I sang the national anthem at Wrigley Field.
Wrigley Field, and do you remember what year it was?
It was August 23rd, 2011. How could I ever forget the date, the time, and the nerves that I still feel when I think about it? No, I became friends with Len Casper.
Right.
Who is the Cubs announcer? Fantastic guy, and he was a fan of my first books,
right.
And we became friends, and just a terrific guy. And he's a fan of my music and my band as well,
right.
Called the Red Button. And we were just talking. It turned into I get a call from the PR person from the Cubs, and they said,
right.
Listen, pick a day for which you want to do the national anthem. I'm thinking to myself, wow, I thought, I kind of confused the seventh inning stretch and thinking, well, taking it out of the ball game is a little different because who cares, right?
Yeah.
But I said, I always like to go for the big stuff,
right,
to see if I can do it.
Right.
And you're always bolder before the actual event happens.
Oh, yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
Right. So it was a game against the Braves, the Cubs and the Braves. It was late August, as I mentioned, August 23rd. And I took my 9-year-old son at the time, Luke. We fly to Chicago. And for 3 or 4 months, everywhere I went, in my car, wherever, I sang the national anthem. I wanted it to be so ingrained in me.
Right.
I didn't want to be one of these guys that forgot the words.
Right.
It's before the game, and there's tens of thousands of people in the stadium. It happened to be one of those gorgeous baseball nights.
Right.
And the usher, who must have been there since 1910,
yeah.
I joke, but
I know what you mean.
Guy, okay. And he says, get ready. We're about to start the game, so you're going to be up in just about 2 minutes. Standing at the third base gate.
Right.
And at that moment, I forgot all the words. I'm telling you, I really did. I forgot everything. Everything went completely blank to me.
Oh, my gosh.
And I thought to myself, what am I going to do? I really don't know. I couldn't think. It's one of those mental things that just happens to you.
Right.
And I thought, whatever will be. And my son is filming.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so I get to the third baseline, and I just start with, you can't forget the first words.
Right.
But as I'm hearing them, I heard the reverberation.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't even thought about that.
And since I've been in recording studios since I'm 15,
right,
it felt so natural and good that I relaxed 5%.
Right.
And when you relax 5%, you relax, 95%.
Right.
Once you cut it a little bit, it really, and I started to enjoy it. And I'm not one of those singers that can do dipsy doodles with their voice, and I'm not out to show off or anything
right.
like that. I couldn't anyway.
Right.
And I just sang it straight, and I hit that big note at the end, and my son filmed it. It's up on YouTube right now. It's still on YouTube. It's just a funny kind of thing. On the first base side, and all these people, as we went to our seats, are patting me on the back, and they're saying something like, hey, that's the way it should be done. Nice and simple. And that was my favorite comment
right.
from the people in the crowd. And it was many people. But that's what was so much fun about it, because I never like to see somebody make it about the national anthem, make it about themselves.
Right. And they do it way too often.
They do it way too often, and they've done it way too often for way too long.
Yes.
So not that I could have made a show of it anyway. I don't have that kind of voice.
Right.
But I'm glad for that in a way, because it limited me to just wanting to, you know, do it in... It's about the anthem.
Right.
You know?
Right. And you did it justice by doing it the way you did it.
And at Wrigley Field, which is one of those old, you know, where if you gave me a choice of where to ever, if you're going to do one national anthem, it's Wrigley or Fenway.
Right. Right.
You know? So it was a tremendous thrill, obviously. I got to, when one of my books came out, Every Pitcher Tells a Story, I was interviewed by Charlie Gibson, and they had, the producer called me up and said, listen, what do you think would be a great place to do this interview? And I said, you know, I don't know, the mound at Shea Stadium, this is when it was Shea.
Right.
And they said, great idea, let us get back to you. Cut to, I'm in the stands with Charlie Gibson, he's doing the interview with me. And the ushers blocked us from going to the mound. They said, well, you don't have permission. This is even with an ABC crew.
Oh,
and they
gosh.
Wouldn't allow it. And all of a sudden, we see this guy walk across the field. Dave Howard, his name was.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, hey, Seth. I said, Dave, we happen to go to Dartmouth together.
Oh, wow.
And he was the vice president of the Mets. He goes, let him down on the field. Where do you want to go? I'm standing on the mound with Charlie Gibson. I'm telling you, the mound, which hasn't moved.
Right.
And it was where Seaver and Kuzman and Gentry and a whole lot of other guys.
Right.
Okay, Gooden and those guys. But yeah, that was a tremendous thrill, too. So I've gotten a lot of thrills on the field.
Right. I know that you had a thrill off the field one time. And myself and pretty much every one of my colleagues over the years, I've been in the business announcing baseball for 19 years.
Oh, yeah.
And virtually every one of them were inspired to do so by Vin Scully.
Oh, yeah.
And you had contact with Vinny once? Or?
Well, my third book in the Baseball Letters trilogy had come out, Something to Write Home About,
right.
and I got a call from the Dodgers saying, Vin likes your books. Will you be interviewed by him?
Were you shocked by that?
Will I be interviewed by him? Are you kidding me? Wait a minute. Let me pinch myself here.
Yeah.
Let me wake up from this dream. So... I, you know, go down to Dodger Stadium. We set up a time. I go down there, and we're in the Dodger, kind of their clubhouse. They have a restaurant outside the locker room.
Yeah,
center,
right.
And there's a stage set up, and they said, Vin, we'll be coming down the stairs. Now, here, it must be, I don't know, 11, 12 o'clock, and he comes down all dapper. He looks like Vin Scully.
Right,
I mean,
right.
like, you know. And I shook his hand, and I said, I just got to tell you, you know, my dad grew up listening to you.
Right.
I mean, you go a long way back in my world, but it's such an honor. You know, it really is. And he said, hey, I just want to tell you right now, thank you. But this is all about you. It's about your book and about what you've accomplished. I was really blown away by that. He just took it off of him. That moment just took it off of him, and he just... kind of just shown such a lot. You felt good in
right.
Vin Scully's presence. You just feel good. You
yes.
just do. I mean, everything that you feel when you're watching TV or listening to him,
right.
trust me, it's so, it's real. It's so, he's amazing.
Right.
Anyway, at the end of the interview, I said, thank you so much. It's obviously a big thrill for me, but I want to show you something. And I take out of my bag, I said, this is the little roller up along first. And it was the ball that went through Bill Buckner's legs that he made that call. A little roller
right.
up along first. And he takes the ball. And he goes, oh, my God, this is the ball. I said, yeah. We take a picture together with the
right.
ball. Vin's holding the ball, and it's me and him. Crazy, right? He goes, just a second. You're not going anywhere. He goes, he whispered in the guy's ear, and the guy takes me out to the field. He takes me up to the first baseline. They were playing the Marlins that day. This is
right.
2003.
Okay.
And he said, Seth Sorsky, Bill Robinson, who was the first base coach. Now, he happened to be the first base coach for the Mets.
That's right.
In that play.
1986.
And he says, show him the ball that you just showed Vin Scully. So I showed him the ball. He goes, oh, and he read it. This is the ball. It's on the ball. He goes, oh, my God. It's incredible. Now, Bill Robinson to me was not the first base coach for the Mets that thrilled me. It was the fact that he played for the Yankees in the late 60s and early 70s. You know, he was an outfielder. Yeah. He was fast. He was, you know. Anyway, that was a thrill. And all of a sudden, he says, hey, guys. And the whole Marlins team was on the field. The pitchers were running sprints in the outfield. Everybody was there. He says, come on in. You got to see this. And I don't remember their third baseman's name, but he was one of their heavy hitters. And you would know it. And I can't think of
David Wright?
No. For the Marlins.
Oh, for the Marlins.
Yeah. You know who it is.
Miguel Cabrera playing third before he moved to first.
No, this was a real good player of theirs. And I'm
Mike Lowell?
Yes. Mike Lowell. Yes. Mike Lowell. Terrific guy.
Yeah.
And he takes the ball, and he's holding. I took a picture of it. And this is when cell phones weren't taking pictures. Right. I had a camera on me. And all the Marlins crowd around him, and they're looking at the ball. And I realized at that moment, that play to these players of this age, right, that was their Bobby Thompson moment.
Right.
They were holding basically the ball that Bobby Thompson hit.
Right.
You know what I'm saying. That was the moment. They were all 10 at the time.
Right.
Or 12, whatever they were. And it just turns out that they went to the World Series and won it that year.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It was a great experience to see players react that way, and they're all, I'm on the field with the Marlins. Right. It's crazy.
Right. We're going to go to our station break again. And when we come back, I want to ask you about some of the memorabilia and how you got into that. So we will be right back with Seth Swirsky.
Doc's Clubhouse, blogtalkradio.com.
Phoenix listeners and listeners visiting Phoenix, for the best sports bar experience in town, it's Brennan's Pub, 34th Street and Bell Road in Phoenix. The best sports bar, dining experience, and atmosphere you will find in the Valley. For great food, great scenery, all of your favorite sports teams on the big screen TVs. Happy hour Monday through Friday from 3 to 7 p.m. And Saturday-Sunday happy hour from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. Good food, good people, good times. That's Brennan's Pub.
Hi, this is Seth Swirsky, and you are in the clubhouse with the Doctor of Baseball, and so am I, only on blogtalkradio.com.
Doc's Clubhouse with Eric Lindeberg, the Doctor of Baseball.
And we are back for what will be the final segment tonight. And Seth, you mentioned that baseball that we just talked about. You got into memorabilia quite heavy, did you not?
Yes. Very much. And, just seeing that some of these pieces were available, before I knew it, I had the third home run that Reggie hit in the 77 World Series in Game 6.
Wow.
He had written number 3 on the ball with all the records he broke on it.
Right.
And as I mentioned before, the ball that went through Buckner's legs, even the letter written by Kennesaw Mountain Landis to Shoeless Joe Jackson telling him he was banned from baseball. So there were a lot of things in there that were really quite special, and it was really, it was a collection of about 300 pieces that were carefully selected.
Right.
And I ended up selling most of my collection back in 2012 at an auction.
Right.
And I don't miss it. I had a fantastic time for 15 years, 20 years, whatever it was, but it was just a joy to be around those pieces and imagine, right, hey, this ball was used in the first night game, ever played in Brooklyn. You know, that kind of thing. You know, it's just, I loved all the small pieces and the big pieces.
Right.
As well. Even the things like I had, Jose Canseco's cap when the ball was hit out to the outfield, he was playing the outfield and it hit off his head and it went over the fence for a home run.
How did you wind up getting something like that?
Well, it wasn't advertised as like the number one thing in an auction, and you have to kind of be really on top of things.
Right.
When I saw that, I thought nobody's going to think too highly of this, but man, that's a piece of baseball history because you're seeing it all the time.
Oh, yeah.
As one of the great bloopers. Well, it turns out that I'm eating sushi on Sunset Boulevard in L.A., and Jose Canseco sits down next to me. So I said, Jose, I got to tell you, I own the hat that you were wearing that day. He goes, keep it. You can keep it. It hurt. It's hilarious.
That's the kind of reaction I would expect from Jose.
Right.
We're out of time now, Seth, unfortunately. But I wanted to ask you, how can our listeners get a hold of you if they want to find your work or they want to reach out to you somehow?
Well, you can go on my Facebook page, which is open to everybody. It's my name is Seth Swirsky, with a Y at the end of my last name. Or my website, seth.com. And I have a new album out called Circles and Squares that you might like. Very kind of...
It's been getting good reviews, I know that.
Yeah, won a lot of year-end polls and really, really fun. And I have a new book coming out called 21 Ways to a Happier Depression. I'm also a clinical psychotherapist. Comes
That's
out
right.
April 1st. And
April 1st?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, so all my work is up there, and I sign everything if you order it through my site. Whatever, just to have fun. That's where you can reach me, seth.com.
Okay. Well, great. I want to thank you again for being here and giving us so much of your time. It's very generous of you. And the last question I have is, will you join me again in Doc's Clubhouse?
Oh, please. Let's make a date right now for it.
We can do that. Okay. Well, thank you again, Seth. And to all your listeners, I want to thank Sal DeGuardia, our producer. Thank all of our advertisers. And we will be back again next week.
Thank you for subscribing to Doc's Clubhouse. New shows every Friday, only on blogtalkradio.com.